OTB.
Don't shoot.
Oh, he dinked it. Oh! It's a goal! It's a goal!
That's it.
What a
Rafinha
hit! Oh, 15 seconds left.
That is amazing.
OTB live commentary. Never miss the action right here on OTB Sports Radio. Keep up to date with the latest scores on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Sports app. Live score updates straight to your phone. The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Yeah, you're very welcome along. So, headlines first of all on the Sunday Papers this afternoon. It's all about the derby last night at Anfield. Worst in 100 years. Liverpool 0, Everton 2. The back page of the Mail here. And it's not good. Liverpool lose derby in a record fourth straight defeat at home for sorry Klopp. And that is the theme right across the back pages. It's all about Liverpool, Everton really. Liverpool 0, Everton 2. The Sun, Reds on worst run for nearly a century. Klopp suffers first KO in derby. Last time Blues won at Anfield, 1999. Fifth victory for Carlo over Liverpool. Phil Thomas here. Jurgen Klopp looked a broken man as Liverpool slumped to their worst run in nearly a century. And then above that, Brian's too good. Brian Fenton winning his second Footballer of the Year award. Makes him only the second footballer in history to do so, says Gordon Manning here. Dublin midfielder claimed the award in 2018 as well. He joins Trevor Giles as the other, who did it in 96 and 99. The only winners twice of the accolade. Brian Fenton, it's not going to be the last time you suspect he wins it either. Next to the Sunday World, at the top you have Let Kids Out to Play, the likes of Pat Spillane, Paddy Christie, Aidan O'Rourke, Kevin Cassidy, Sean McGoldrick, all lending their voice to that cause. And beneath that, it's Seamus Coleman giving Richarlison a big hug after he scored that early goal last night. Red all over is the headline. Sunday Times go with that same picture, Coleman jumping up on Richarlison. Anfield in ruins, Liverpool lose four successive games at home as Everton end 22-year wait for a win. And then beside that, it's the Thomas Tuchel, Hudson-Odoi situation. If you didn't see this yesterday, Chelsea drew 1-1 with Southampton, and Thomas Tuchel brought Callum Hudson-Odoi on and then took him off 31 minutes later. 20 years of age now, Hudson-Odoi. And he says, I wasn't happy with his attitude, his energy, his counter-pressing, so I took him off. We demand 100%. If I feel he's not in the right shape to help us, then I'll take him off. I wasn't happy with his body language. We cannot lack energy, 10% or 5%. It's not possible. So Thomas Tuchel laying down the law. The Observer, Anfield agony. Richarlison sets Everton on way to first derby win at Liverpool since 1999. Klopp's fourth successive defeat at home. And the picture there is of Richarlison about to score. We have a Sunday Independent then. Again, it's Everton. Everton break Poole's grip in Mersey Derby. And beside that, Holland leads way for Red Hot Munster. They beat Edinburgh 22 points to 10 last night. And then beneath that, on the All-Stars, Treaty on top with 9 awards. Limerick, 9 players in the All-Stars. And just to mention, The Observer, by the way, hopefully we're seeing something like this pretty soon here. The front page of the news section of The Observer caught the eye. Ban on outside sport can end, top scientist urges Johnson. So this is Professor Mark Woolhouse of Edinburgh University, who was advising the government. And he says that the data now shows there's no need for the government to be ultra cautious. He said, the government has said the country's exit from lockdown should be data driven. Well, the data is extremely good, far better than anyone, including me, anticipated 2 or 3 weeks ago. Hospitalizations, deaths, and case numbers have all plunged, while vaccinations have already reached a quarter of the adult population. And so he says it's time to have outside sport back over in England. So hopefully we're not too far behind them. Neil O'Riordan, chief sports writer with The Sun, is with us. Colm Keyes, who covers GAA for the Irish Independent, also with us. Gents, thanks so much for the time. Great to have you on.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
So we'll jump right in. I mean, there's lots going on. The rugby is dominant. I know you both picked out a couple of rugby pieces. Neil, what caught your eye? What's the general thrust on Andy Farrell and Irish rugby right now across the papers?
Well, I think the jury's very much out. What struck me with the Sunday Times was two quite different takes from Shane Horgan and Stuart Barnes. Stuart Barnes' kind of take, and you know, there's almost a qualification that he says he's from his perch across the Irish Sea, which maybe hints at maybe not being as close to it to offer a detailed analysis as he might do otherwise. But his suggestion is that, you know, he was playing last year when Farrell beat Scotland and Wales at the start of the Six Nations, and that, you know, Ireland could easily have won the first two games of this Six Nations, which is of course true. But I think, you know, so he's suggesting that we shouldn't be just looking at the results. He's claiming that Ireland are an improved side compared to last year, and that very much goes against what Shane Horgan is saying, and I think what would be the more general feeling is that there hasn't been sufficient signs of progress under Farrell. I think people would acknowledge that the set piece has improved since Paul O'Connell came in. That was an area of big concern, particularly the line-out in the autumn. There's been an immediate improvement in that regard. But the focus is on the attack and, you know, the bare stats of two tries in two games, one of which is very opportunistic. And Horgan is basically asking, you know, where are we going? What is Farrell's philosophy as such? And that kind of feeds into Ian Henderson was made available for interview for the Sunday papers, and I was in on that one. And, you know, he was at one point asked what represents a good result in Italy, and he basically said a 5-point win, any sort of win. But I then went in with a follow-up question and said, but that's not really good enough, isn't it? Because if you win by 5 points in Italy but don't produce a convincing performance, all the doubts that currently exist will still exist after the game. You know, they won't be masked by the result in the way that Barnes seemed to suggest things were maybe being masked last year. You know, and he then, Henderson, to be fair, did concede yes, say we need to show progress. We feel it's there internally and we haven't produced it for you to be able to see it. And that's a huge frustration. And so he did kind of come around full circle from saying that the win was the bottom line to acknowledging, no, they actually needed to show, you know, quantifiable progress in terms of the team's attack and the way they were going.
Yeah. And does he sound convincing when he says that they feel like they're making progress and we're just not seeing it yet, Neil?
Well, he does, but...
They always do.
Yeah, exactly. They're not going to say anything different. So, yeah, I mean... You're not saying that they're lying, because, you know, if they don't believe in what they're doing, then what hope is there? You know, clearly there has to be buy-in, and you would hope that there is, but ultimately it has to be there for us to see. And, you know, they know that too. And that's you know, you essentially acknowledge that in the end, you know.
The headline in Shane Horgan's piece in the Sunday Times is, give us a clue, Farrell has been head coach for a year. It's time to loosen up and add some offloading to game plan. And ultimately that's one of the key points Shane Horgan is making, Colm. He's talking about the Schmidt era and how it ended. It coincided with defences becoming too aggressive and too well drilled. And so suddenly now, the length of time that you have the ball for, and Schmidt teams always had the ball for a long time, that doesn't really count for very much anymore. And he makes the point that Ireland had 61% possession against Wales. They had 56% possession against France, and yet Ireland lost both games. Defences are relatively comfortable tackling big ball carriers or reacting to phase play that incorporates a loop, a switch or a blocker play. What defences find challenging are offloads. Wales offload the ball once every 19 carries. France, one every 9 carries. Ireland averaged one offload every 54 carries, which jumps out. And he said maybe the 14 men against Wales was part of that, but at the same time, it's clearly not part of the team's DNA. And then he talks about the kicking strategy and, again, the over-reliance on the box kick, used frustratingly in the middle of the pitch for some reason, and last time out against France, an 80s style up and under off perfect first phase ball on the 40 metre line. He concludes by saying, over the remaining three rounds, Farrell needs to embrace the reality that Ireland need an offload game and demonstrate what else makes up his rugby philosophy. I mean, that's a big old change to expect mid Six Nations there, Colm.
It is. I suppose that piece, Joe, for anybody who likes the finer points of the game and the nuance of the game, there's a lot, certainly a lot in that. The possession statistics interest me, because looking at the games over the previous two weekends, I've certainly come away with the impression, and I know it differs greatly from what the general theme was, that Ireland have actually been okay in both of those games. They haven't played too bad. That's my impression looking at it. Maybe it's based on the possession. And as Shane points out there, what's been done in particular points of the field is probably what's to their detriment. But overall, looking at it with a broad sweep, I feel Ireland are okay. They're coming off, like Stuart Barnes, and Neil referenced Stuart Barnes' piece, saying Ireland have improved. Ireland are actually coming off a very low base over the last 3 years. They're in the midst of a third poor Six Nations Championship with a very poor World Cup, ultimately a poor World Cup campaign there as well, but it never really sparked. So since 2018, you're coming off a low base. I don't think they've gone back. They might have slightly improved in some parts of the game, gone back in others. Obviously at half back, I would obviously feel that the Sexton-Murray combination are nowhere near as good as they were, obviously. And the replacements are, you know, filling in for two players of that stature is always going to be difficult for the next players in. If it was Joey Carberry, maybe the transition would have been a lot easier because he's been there longer. But for all the rest, for all those other halfbacks, it could be pretty daunting stepping into Sexton and Murray at any stage. And interestingly, Brendan Fanning has a piece in the Sunday Independent where he's makes a determination that cash will determine who plays halfback next weekend. And the difference between fourth and sixth in the Six Nations is £1 million. And right now, the IRFU could really do with finishing fourth instead of sixth, obviously. So the imperative is to go out and beat Italy and beat them well. And that's why he's convinced it will be Sexton and Murray and not any combination of Burns or Carty or anybody else coming in. So he feels that they will go conservative, as in their best two players. There will be no experimentation. And that's determined by the prize of finishing fourth, given the financial peril that the RFU and obviously other sporting organisations are in right now. But something that really jumped out at me in the Stuart Barnes piece, and it's down at the bottom of it, is where he says, I'm not really sure, and I'll read it here, but he's casting doubt on Andy Farrell and Mike Catt. Mm. He says, I'm unsure whether Farrell and Catt are the right men for Ireland. And before that, he wonders, you know, in their days as England coaches, Farrell and Mike Catt were not renowned for fresh, invigorating thinking, which is what Shane Horgan is calling for. So I would have thought that was almost a headline. Farrell and Catt may not be the right men for Ireland, that Stuart Barnes is saying that. Fellow Englishman who obviously knows them, and with Catt there would be a bad connection there in the past. I would have thought that would have jumped out really more, apart from Ireland, you know, being a better side.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's conventional thinking that Farrell and Catt are not.
Well, you know, I think it's certainly brewing.
Right.
Yeah, I listened to a huge number of podcasts and read everything over the last week, and I think the analysis is very, very damning, and yet maybe just a combination of human decency and it's so early in the regime is preventing people from coming out and saying it. But I, listening to any number of really respected pundits on various podcasts, various channels, there's definitely a brewing concern, to say the least. And actually, even in the Stuart Barnes thing as well, where he talks about Ireland improving, he does say, so I mean, faint praise, stop staring at the scoreboard, compare the quality of performance. Ireland are an improved team. They are not, however, a good side. So it's like, before you know, you're improving, but you really are not a good side.
That goes back to the point I made, Joe. They're actually coming off a low base. I think we're still stuck in 2018 and before that. Ireland have disimproved a lot.
Yeah.
And in areas of the game over the last parts of their game have improved. And Neil referenced the, you know, the line out and perhaps the scrum have improved. And maybe that is true, the work of Paul O'Connell. I don't know. But there have been, certainly the Irish line out has been a bit of a mess. And it has improved. Certainly from an attacking point of view, they are a bit stilted. There is no question that they do not have the line break. And obviously Shane Horgan is calling for more offloads here. And as you say, Joe, it's going to be very, very difficult to change that midstream when there has been a premium on kicking and crashing. And there hasn't been a whole lot of deviation evident from the tail end of the Schmidt years.
And it was so. Just it stands out because it was so rare in the reorganised Italy game in the last year's Six Nations in October. There was a Peter O'Mahony offload, and we all swooned because we thought, okay, this is what we're building towards. This is what has been spoken about. Now we're seeing evidence of it. The only problem is we're still referencing that as an example of what we're trying to do six or seven games on, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, talking about more offloads, I feel like we were having those conversations after the defeat to Japan at the World Cup, you know, that Ireland need to move more in that direction. So maybe, look, maybe Neil Joe Schmidt has completely just ruined all our expectations for, you know, every future coach, like two championships and a Grand Slam in the space of 5 years. He beat the All Blacks twice. I think if you want our previous three Six Nations wins, you're going back to the 80s, you know, and Schmidt does it in 5 years. So we're grappling with, like, actually what is, because the IRFU set out the aim of, and now it looks ludicrous. At the time under Schmidt, it seemed plausible, but the IRFU aim now every World Cup cycle is to win the Six Nations twice, to get to the next World Cup semi-final and to be ranked third in the world. We're currently sixth, and I doubt we're going to win the next two Six Nations. So, you know, all our expectations seem to inflate massively under Schmidt.
Yeah, I did a piece last week, and basically he was the fourth coach in a row who had left a team in a better place from when he'd taken it on. And there comes a point with any team, but specifically with a smaller nation, where you can't keep doing that. Like, it can't keep happening. But, and Colin touched on there in terms of what Brendan Fanning said about the prize money, and that's inescapable, but it does seem that those World Cup aims and Six Nations aims will forever be in conflict, you know, and we're not going to realise our World Cup goals while still saying the Six Nations are bread and butter. We have to do this, this, and this in the Six Nations. And, you know, talk about trying to balance short-term, medium to long-term plans. But the reality, as we've seen in every World Cup, that it is just proven impossible to do that. And so unless they're prepared, and now isn't the time, obviously, because of what's happened with COVID-19, it's, the union isn't robust financially, but maybe down the line when things have recovered, maybe there has to be, and I don't know how you frame this, because you don't want to, in your kind of strategic plans, it's an odd thing to do to lower expectations or aims. Well, maybe you have to attend Six Nations if you want to specifically target the World Cup and achievement there.
Yeah. Eamon Sweeney, back page of the Sunday Independent. Team of us, more like team of whoever's handy. This is not a new complaint, but he's talking about the IRFU's overseas player policy. He says it cheapens the green jersey. They're not only selling the soul of Irish rugby, but getting a poor price for it. He says, of more than a dozen overseas players capped for Ireland, only two, CJ Stander and Bundiaki, could be regarded as an unqualified success. Talks about, you know, the high point being St. Patrick's Day 2018, when Aki and Stander combined for that try. He says, its nadir was reached last Sunday as Gibson Park's mistake presented France with their first try. James Lowe's lacklustre defence contributed to their second, and Billy Burns added to his kicking disaster from the previous week by failing to see a massive overlap in the opening minutes. He says, then again, though, devotees of the project may regard the match as a high point, given Ireland started with five overseas players in their lineup. Fully one-third of an Irish team was composed of men who not long ago were hoping to play for New Zealand, South Africa and England. A percentage like that is in danger of turning Ireland into not so much a national team as a franchise. Team of us, team of whoever's handy, more like. And national pride might not seem like a terribly sophisticated concept, but it's an essential part of international competition. Without it, why have national teams at all? Neil, thoughts?
Yeah, I see the argument. I think the important thing to note, though, is the qualification period has been extended out from 3 to 5 years. So I don't think it's on a slippery slope where things are going to get worse. Like, I think there was a recognition within the game that it had gone too far, and so that the residency rule has gone up to 5 years. So it will become less of an issue because it becomes more difficult to get players and unions to look that far in advance. You still will have some players who will qualify through that, but you know, it's hard to look 5 years down the line in terms of recognising somebody who has Irish qualification. I mean, it's an issue in all sports across the world. Like, maybe it's not in football in Ireland, because obviously there's not a league of sufficient quality that you would be bringing players in with a view to capping them. And plus, FIFA have changed the rules there, so it's become a bit more difficult. But, you know, it happens in lots of different fields. I agree that it does dilute the essence of international sports, so you do have to be very careful about it. I think picking individual mistakes by individual players isn't really a great way to go about it, because you're scapegoating individuals for what is a rule that's in place, and the union have availed of it, as have other unions. Like, I don't think it's really beneficial to start saying, well, that player who isn't really Irish made this mistake in that game. I mean, that's a bit of a dangerous road to start going down.
Yeah. So it's almost more egregious if a Gibson Park makes a mistake as opposed to a Gary Ringrose.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, what point are you making there? Are you saying it matters less to them? You know, I don't know. And you know, some of the other, you know, yeah, he mentioned diversity in the article too, and I think, you know, he mentioned about Ulton Dolan missing out because of other players, and referencing Ulton Dolan's skin colour. Ulton Dolan was born in France, obviously with an Irish parent. But, you know, at what point do you start, you know, where exactly do you draw the line in what's okay and what's not okay? It is a nuanced argument, I think. So I just think you need to be very careful picking out specific examples to try and illustrate it, you know?
Yeah, Colm?
I suppose Billy Burns, just to qualify, doesn't he qualify for Ireland through grandparents?
Yes.
So he could not be classed as a project player. I would probably remove him. But
I think Eamon likes to make that point.
He says of Burns, though, Burns not a project player per se, as he qualifies under the grandparent rule. But given that he won an under-20 World Cup with England, his joining of the Irish ranks at the age of 25 seems just as opportunistic.
There's an interesting statistic provided by Brendan Fanning in the piece that he writes, where he says the IRFU provided a list of 25 current players who made their senior provincial debuts in the last 2 years. The age range for those debutants was 19 to 21. So while this is not linked to the back page piece in the Sunday Independent, it still provides some background to it, and that there are a lot of young players between 19 and 21 graduating through the system, through the provincial ranks. And I suppose there is an argument to say that these project players, and some of them have backfired in Ireland. I think, you know, Jan Klein's inclusion in the World Cup squad in 2019 at the expense of Devon Toner at the time probably backfired. And, you know, it probably looks like the halfback situation may not work out, although Gibson Park has been flagged as a potential replacement, that's for sure. But there does seem to be a lot of players coming through, and the question is, you know, are they being, their progress being slowed down by the presence of project players, and is it the best policy? Right now, it doesn't look like it is. The successes haven't been the more recent. There hasn't been any recent successes in that respect. But you look at New Zealand, you look at Australia, and the number of players that they take in from the South Sea Islands, the Pacific Islands, and the benefit that they get from that too. And that has really worked well in their favour, albeit taken in at a younger age and brought into academies, but brought in nonetheless from other countries.
Neil, I think you made the key point when you said that the residency rule has been extended. You know, this article reads as if that hasn't happened. You know, that's the key development in the last couple of years, from 3 years out to 5 years. And also, like, the notion that we judge how we feel about this thing based on how many players have done well for Ireland and how many haven't. I mean, one, it's too personalised, and secondly, like, let's just stick to the principle of the thing, you know, as opposed to saying, well, we got good value out of Aki, we got good value out of Standard. So, like, if we win the World Cup and the other players he mentions, like Strauss and Rodney Ayew and Jean Klein and Quinn Roux, all do marvellous things, do we feel better about it then? I mean, we're either for it or against it.
Sure, yeah. And, like, it just struck me as well that one of the other players that was mentioned there was Rhys Ruddock. I mean, Rhys Ruddock spent most of, you know, of his early life in Wales, obviously to one Irish parent and a Welsh parent. So, like, it is a bit more nuanced. And like you say, the success, I guess, in overall terms, yes, the success of it should be considered. And there's a similar argument in football where, you know, players born in England with Irish parentage win underage caps, and in Declan Rice's case, senior caps, at the expense of Irish-born players. And you know, by them being capped, they Irish-born players who we know aren't going to ever go to another team, they are missing out on that exposure to international competition, which can be crucial to their development. So it is an issue. And like I think in all sports, it should always be seen as an additional thing to your main thing of player development, which is bringing through players through your own systems, developing your own, and then having this add-on that, you know, if there's an exceptional player who can add to your squad, then yes, you bring them in. I think sometimes as well, what's happened, like I remember the one that kind of really sticks, and I know I've made the argument against individual cases, but this isn't so much against the individual, but the way the individual was presented when Michael Bent was brought in Declan Kidney's time, and he played for Ireland before he played for Leinster. And we were sat in a press conference where Michael Bent's Irishness was stressed on the basis that his sister had competed, and I think it arose a Tralee competition, you know, that maybe she played a tin whistle or something. Right. And you're kind of, you know, don't take us for fools. Like,
yeah,
we know you have a big problem at prop, and this is why this player's been brought over. He has an Irish link, that's fine. You know, we're not going to ask him to recite the proclamation to prove his Irishness. But don't try and sell us this kind of twee notion of, you know, it's okay to do this because his sister was in the Rose of Tralee. You know, I think that's where, you know,
it's disingenuous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just recognize that it was a means to an end. The problem needs to be solved, and he was a solution.
Yeah.
However, perfect.
And to be fair to Eamon, I don't want to misrepresent his point. He is saying, when he cites some of the lesser examples, that, well, we are selling the soul of Irish rugby, but we're getting a poor price for it, is also the point he's making, like when it's not even working out. And to be honest, like, I was glad to see the residency rule go from 3 to 5 years. I think it was being taken advantage of. I think it was devaluing the whole point of international competition. Like, it's brilliant when the likes of a Dougie Howlett or a Scott Fardy or an Issa Nasewa rock up and play for the provinces and make the domestic game more interesting and get more bums on seats. It's great for rugby. I mean, the more the better. Let's absolutely. But when it's diluting the national, I'm not even going to say Irish team, I'm talking national competition, Scotland, all countries are at it. I mean, it does make a mockery of what international competition is supposed to be. If it's not supposed to be international competition, then let's call it something else, Colin, was almost the feeling, I think.
I'd be inclined to agree with that, Joe, that, and I think there should probably be a limit on the number of project players that can play on any international team. And at two probably sounds right. That this limited to two. If there was, you know, five last weekend, or possibly six last weekend, if you include Burns and Ruddock in that, and I don't think it's probably fair to include Ruddock, but you know, that's probably too many, and that does dilute it, and it does prevent opportunities for other homegrown players to get through and play on their international team. And that's what it is. International rugby is representative rugby, and that's what it should really reflect. So if there are a limit of two players that have been living in the country and working obviously in the country for 5 years and have made Ireland their home for such a long time, well, maybe there's a facility there. But I certainly think international rugby is representative, and there should be a pretty strict cap on this.
Yeah, and in fairness, we should point out Rhys Ruddock was born in Dublin. I know he grew up in Wales, and Billy Burns qualifies via the grandparent rule. I mean, one last point on all this, Neil, it will be interesting to see how the five-year rule plays out now. Will nations be going across to certain hotspots and trying to pick up the, you know, hot 18, 19-year-old talent and saying, come back, and sure, look, 18 and 5, by the time you're 23, we'll get 10 great years out of you. Well, you know, almost akin to football clubs going around looking for young players.
Yeah, it's difficult to kind of predict with that. I mean, obviously, Munster brought in a couple of South African young players at one stage, so it kind of happened to some degree already. But yeah, I think it will become less prevalent when there's the five-year aspect to it.
Let's go for something totally different. We are moving off rugby, but if we go to Neil Francis, I mean, you never quite know what he's going to come up with. And I think we all thought this piece was a really good read. He's talking about a night in Chicago where he bumped into Leon Spinks with a couple of the Irish team. Now, Leon Spinks, for lots of listeners, the name will more than ring a bell. He passed away of prostate cancer this month, and he came from a very tough background.
He escaped to the Marines, and then he won gold at the Olympics in Montreal, the same medal Muhammad Ali had won 16 years earlier. And in his eighth pro fight, and he hadn't even won his previous, all of his previous seven, he gets a fight against Ali, shocks the world. Ali hasn't trained very well. Spinks is young, he's fit, he's hungry, and he wins on a split decision, and suddenly he's beaten Muhammad Ali, and it's, you know, it's unbelievable. The rematch happens 7 months later. 2 billion people watch it. Ali trains properly. Spinks didn't. Famously, Bob Arum found him drunk in the hotel a couple of days out from the fight in the morning, having come back from a big night out. Not surprisingly, he loses the fight. He boxed into his 40s, ended up in a very bad way. Lost all his money. Like, I think for the Ali fight, he got $3.5 million, which is the equivalent of $14 million today, which should kind of see you home if you're careful enough. But it went, between the wrong people around him, between two divorces, between various issues. He ended up in a homeless shelter and had a very sad end, I think, in the end. So he passed away earlier this month. And Colm, it got Neil Francis remembering an interesting evening in Chicago.
Well, I suppose, Joe, during an international break after in the Six Nations, and Ireland have, on the back of two defeats, and you open the Sunday Independent, and you would expect that Neil Francis would be critically analysing that. But I have to say, this is a fantastic article, really, really enjoyable to read it. I put this at number one in anything I've read in all the papers. I really enjoyed it. It's obviously so different. And it's told, obviously, in the first person, because Neil and Gary Halpin are in a bar or a nightclub, as it was, in Chicago during the 1989 tour of North America. And they spot Leon Spinks, and he's signing autographs and posing for photographs for $10. And they obviously approach him, not realizing there's a fee to this, and it takes off from there. And they sit down and have a drink with him. And Leon Spinks's drink is a glass of water. But he takes the money for the drink that he's supposed to have with them. And it's clearly that's his job. He's a host in the nightclub, a well-known host. And that's after, stepping into the ring with Ali twice. And I have to show my age here. I was one of the 2 billion that watched one of those fights. I can't remember, but I was 7 or 8 years of age. And I do remember getting up to watch one of those two fights. I can't remember which, but Ali and Spinks, I definitely remember in the middle of the night getting up with the rest of the family to watch that one. But this is, it's great, the recall and how they break him down, essentially, because he's at a distance from them initially. And then after drinking the glass of water, he has a drink with them. But I think it's and settles down with them for the night. And it's nearly at the end of the night that they part company, and he goes off to somebody else. And of course, he buys a round eventually as well. So they settle into his company. But really what the story reflects is boxing's tragedy. And at one stage, Neil references him going to the, leaving their company at one stage and coming back. And he's his temperament has changed. And clearly there's an inference there that he had taken something during his time away from them. So, really, this is a reflection of one of boxing's hard stories. Joe Louis, Joe Frazier, even Mike Tyson, they've all lost a lot of money. And in the case of Louis and even Frazier, who lived in an apartment above, a one-bedroom apartment above his gym at the end of his life, boxing can throw up these stories. Probably none worse than Spinks, who ended up working in a McDonald's, I think it was, in Nebraska or somewhere like that. So, it was a very interesting meeting. It's told very well, and it's really well worth a read for anyone that's interested in boxing life stories. And Neil Francis and Gary Halpin's meeting here really, really reflects a tragic element of boxing.
Yeah, brilliantly written. Neil Francis always just such a great way of putting something together. And it's, as you said, it's funny. I mean, it's laugh out loud kind of stuff when they realize he wants $10 for a photo. They're like, they're like, what?
And they break the ice with him over training. There's a remark in the middle of it there about, thought you guys had training in the morning, Spinks says to them, obviously wanting to get away and Francis or Halpin says, we do, but the pair of us are almost as bad at training as you, Leon. And that breaks the ice and he settles down and he some sort of fellowship with them, maybe that in that regard. And he has a few more drinks with them when he should be off trying to source $10 elsewhere in the club. So he's at his ease. And obviously, as I said, he leaves and comes back and his temperament has changed in some ways and his eyes have changed. Yeah. And that leads on to obviously everything else that happened in his career. That was reflective of it. But as I said, really, really good piece and not what you'd expect in a break in the Six Nations, but very, very good.
No, I'm sure Andy Farrell's at home thinking, grand, suits me. right away, Neil, right away. The champ took a break and went to the men's and came back 10 minutes later. The eyes were gone, his temperament had changed. I suppose I was only 25 at the time, but I regret what happened next. If you look in Spinks's lapel in the photo on the right-hand side of his jacket, there's a badge that reads, say no to drugs. What did you take, Leon? Why did he need to take stuff when he was having some fun? He had no answers. He just felt like doing it, and he did it. And the comfort blanket of cocaine gave him a temporary safety net until the next insecurity arrived. We slagged him, and he joined in himself. It was one of his many redeeming features, his self-deprecating humour. He thought it was funny too, yet drugs had been a foundation stone for the ruination of his life, writes Neil Francis. And then as they're saying goodbye, his last words to me, you've got soft hands, Fran, which is just... it's both funny and there's something very poignant about it. You've got soft hands, Fran. We walked out the door into the rain. And then Neil Francis concludes by saying, my only thought when I read about his demise was obvious regret and then an answer to the sacred mystery of how he had managed to live to 67 years of age. Rest easy, champ. Neil?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And the recall even, I'd imagine there were quite a lot of beer consumed at night on Francis's part, so to be able to recall that to the extent he can, however, nearly, 30 odd years on is incredible. It's great, and some of it, I can't remember the internet, there was a very good piece in the last few months by Francis as well, recalling a tour, which was excellent, again, just in its recall, and just a little out of the ordinary, and I guess, as well as an insight into boxing, it's obviously an insight into rugby before the advent of professionalism. And I guess just the more interesting aspect of it, now every interview is particularly in COVID times, are about the team bubble and that not being burst, like not being allowed to see families. And here's guys who are training the next morning, living it up in Chicago nightlife.
Colm, you wanted to mention Colm O'Rourke's piece. He starts it by saying that anyone who reads a GAA report in full should get some kind of a prize. So he's done that.
Yeah, he's gone through it.
Did you go through it?
I did on the day. I went through it looking for a very, obviously, the financial element of it, Joe, was of greatest interest, obviously, after the year that was. Colm is bemoaning the lack of vision, and that's true. There isn't any great vision in it, but I wouldn't have expected too much vision in the year that was, because really it is about survival in one respect, consolidation in another respect. So he's making the point that there is no vision in it, and that's true to a degree. Yes, that's true. But really the financial elements to the GAA's report is really the most interesting. And look, there's been a crescendo up to this. All year they've been briefing counties, they've been briefing chairs of counties and letting them know that our financial situation is not good. And the final audit puts it at 34.1 million, and that's between Croke Park, the stadium, the four provinces, and the 32 counties. And the four provinces of the 32 counties actually didn't do too bad collectively, lost 7 million. Croke Park Stadium has virtually been redundant. No crowds coming in, no commercial, there was going to be no concerts anyway. So the losses are heavy, put down at around 34.1 million, and a projection for more of the same medicine this year, unless it's some more government subvention, which there probably will. But it's interesting that there's a story, and I mentioned it to you earlier, but in the Sunday Times news section about the GAA writing to Catherine Martin, the Minister for Sport, and obviously she's over the broadcasting portfolio too, with media. and they're making a submission that they want to keep as many games. They want to write the rights, obviously, not to have, at the moment, the All-Ireland finals in hurling football and ladies football in Camogie are enshrined by law to be free to air. And Eamon Ryan a few years ago wanted to bring provincial finals and All-Ireland quarterfinals and make them compulsory free to air as well. And the GAA are lobbying against that, according to the Sunday Times, because they want to keep the market open. Mm. And that's in a week when Peter McKenna floated the idea that Amazon Prime might be contenders when the next rights are up at the end of this year. So the GAA want to keep the market open because they want to claw back some of this 34.1 million that has been lost in COVID year. But yes, Colm goes through the report and obviously sees some benefits, the way the GAA pay expenses, the split season, all of that, that kind of fell into place because of COVID. They're able to bring the team cost down from 30 million down to about 19 million, just shy of 19 million. Obviously there was a shorter season, so there are some beneficial spin-offs from all of this, inadvertent as they are, that can be brought forward.
Yeah. Well, that was the interesting one that jumped out to me. I haven't read the report. Is it as bad as Colin Rourke says, by the way?
There's some good bits in it. You know, there's some bits you'd reflect on it.
If I ever write a book, don't review it like that.
They're all they don't really vary much. They are reflective. I have to say, during Pádraig Duffy's years, there was a lot of projecting forward. And there hasn't been a lot of projecting forward here, probably on the basis that you can't project forward because the future is so uncertain, especially over the next 12 months. I would anticipate that next year vision would probably come into it a bit more. But look, all of these reports they have to cover every base. So there's a lot in it that you probably would skip over. It's documentation. It's documenting the year that was. Mm. You will always expect that in an annual report.
Well, he talks about how expenses work. So obviously the government had to give 14 million over to ensure the championships went ahead. And he talks about how county panels were cut to 32. There was a reduction in backroom teams and the expenses were administrated centrally. So he says maybe that's a winning formula by dint of circumstances if it continues into the future, i.e. Expenses controlled centrally and spending controlled centrally. He's not optimistic it'll happen, though.
I would be pretty certain it will happen into the future. I would think that the GAA are really trying to get control of this, and it will be, they will pay directly for 32 on a squad and a backroom of 12, and there'll be set limits for post-training, meal allowances, training, all of that. There will be set fees, and it will be up to counties to generate if they want to keep a squad of 40 or 45. So, you know, while there are benefits of this, it will suit the wealthier counties too. That is it, because they will be able to supplement the 32 with the costs of another 10 and add on to the backroom staff. So the wealthier counties will be able to expand. And that's really why a review of contributions all round is required, so that those that cannot generate and aren't self-sufficient get a greater share of the money. So there is something in it, but it probably needs to be expanded so that those that cannot generate get more.
Okay. Neil, I know Mick Foley's piece with Orla Farmer, the Cork footballer, caught your eye.
Yeah, she was just discussing the challenges, I guess, in keeping girls involved in sport, and just maybe touching on the fact that there is no real provision made for how you might adjust your training to maybe engage girls more to the point that they don't leave. So she had her own kind of videos, Monday fun day, target Tuesday, workout Wednesday, Tai Chi Thursday, and fitness Friday. And that seemed to go down well. I think the dropout rate has been kind of well known in terms of girls. And I guess it's an even bigger issue now at lockdown when people haven't been able to train together. I have a 10-year-old daughter. I coach her team. She wouldn't be the most engaged in terms of physical exercise, but I find that team environment, she doesn't object to going training because she knows her mates are there. Mm. So, you know, to have been without that now since December, you know, it's an issue. So I think once we do get back training, it'll be interesting to see across the board in all sports, you know, what kind of drop-off there has been, and will it be greater than is normal? And she just mentioned a couple of things, like, you know, the introduction of dance in terms of training sessions and how that maybe appeals more to girls, that they're not as into the competitive aspect as much as boys. Obviously, these are generalizations, but you know, it's just kind of interesting that the different approaches that can be taken. I know I've read some stuff on this before that, you know, sometimes the idea of keeping girls active, it's too pigeonholed in terms of actual sport, that it needs to be broadened out. And I guess the introduction of dance there is a way of kind of fusing the two ideas together. So it's just an interesting read for anyone who is involved in sport in terms of coaching girls and trying just to keep them involved that bit later, because I think it is going to be an even bigger issue than normal because of what's gone on over the last year.
Yeah, so Orla Farmer, if the name rings a bell, and it should, she has 6 All-Ireland medals. She was part of that Eamon Ryan team as well, and did part of her degree in PE in sports studies. And then the LGFA were looking to kind of put an academic base behind a Gaelic for Girls project they had. So she saw that and so she's decided to do a PhD in girls and sport and dropout rates. And we all know the statistics and they're stark, and it's, you know, huge numbers dropping out in teenage years. So the big things which came up, and Neil, maybe this tallies your experience of seeing the underage teams, lack of enjoyment, coaches being too strict, body image, self-confidence, not feeling good enough, that side of it. And then there's some stuff which just, I think, applies to everyone: time constraints, other interests. If your friends drop out, you're more likely to drop out. She said the appetite for competition is more intense amongst boys' teams. She said the social aspect for girls was really important. And so, for instance, she asked the question of coaches of girls' teams, in the coaching sessions, are you giving the girls ample time to socialize in a fun way? And are you promoting values that aren't about comparing? So if you're doing a session for an hour and there's no chance within that for the team to socialize, then maybe that's something to look at. Struck me as a very good point to make, very simple one to address as well.
It is, yeah. And but I guess it's I'm sure the coach's viewpoint would be like, I've so little time to them, I've got to get this and this done. So how do you fit that into an hour? So it's a challenge, but like ultimately, if you're losing players, you're not doing very well as a coach. So in as much as you feel you have to get in all these tactical points or skill acquisition points, you know, if you're losing players, it's not much use. So yeah, there's a balance to be struck. And you know, I think this was informative in terms of what can be done to try to help.
Just beside that, Claire on the brink of fiery implosion. This could really blow up in the next couple of days, I think. I mean, it you know, it's hard to predict these things, but a few different people are writing about a column. Mick Foley here, for instance, beside this Orla Farmer piece. It seems there's just a deep unhappiness in Clare GAA with the county board. And so last year, Niall O'Connor, he's the coach of the minor hurling team, he wrote a letter to every club in Clare. This was last October, and he was bemoaning what's going on. He was talking about how the Clare under 16 hurlers have been left without a manager since March. There was no coach, no strength and conditioning, no guidance. A scandal is what he wrote. This went to every club in Clare. And then he broadened out and touched on all sorts of topics. So, you know, Clare's state-of-the-art training facility cost $5 million, and yet it still has pitch drainage issues. And so the squad have to train elsewhere during the winter. He asked why Clare's development teams weren't being overseen by more All-Ireland winners. Anthony Daly, the heartbeat and leader of our 95-97 winning teams and former director of Limerick's Hurling Academy, said he was unsure if he could work with a number of top officials in the county board. The culture is all wrong. So the point that Niall O'Connor makes in his letter, if I was the person holding that man and others of that ilk back, I would walk out the door for the good of Clare Hurling. Now, Mick Foley writes that the letter resisted directly criticising Pat Fitzgerald, who's Clare's long-standing full-time secretary. But the inference was clear. And so there's trouble brewing there, Colm.
Yes, certainly seems so, and it probably is. You know, without it being spelled out, there, it probably does revolve around Pat Fitzgerald's stewardship. Just from reading the pieces here, he's been long time Clare. He's now full time secretary, and obviously he's Davy's father. But the Aero Club wrote that letter in, and they were proposing a complete overhaul of Clare GAA and wanted a strategic committee to be put in place. And in the meantime, the board suggested their own four committees to oversee football, hurling, commercial, Cathair Lóthain, which is their development, their centre of excellence, which has been, the gym is too small, there's drainage issues, and the Clare hurling team last year had to go and find other pitches. And there's been issues around Clare hurling too, just from reading. Dermot Crowe has a piece in the Sunday Independent and Michael Foley, so they've both been focusing on this because there was a meeting scheduled for Friday night about all of this, and it's been put back to next Tuesday. Bottom line was the board appointed chairs for and committee members under their proposal, but Air Óg, the club, have come back with their own proposed committee, a broader one committee to oversee everything, and it involves some CEOs of companies. Tony Garry is one name that stands out. He was once head of Davies, so he's on board, according to Air Óg, for this. So there seems to be a difference of where a review in Clare should go. The board have an idea that what they want to do, but the club that's proposing this, and Niall O'Connor, who I think is Gerry O'Connor, the former joint manager's son, is looking at it. They're looking at it differently. They have proposed their own committee. So it's down to the clubs now in Clare to decide what route they want to go with this. Do they back the club that initiated this process in the first place, or do they run with the board's proposal, which includes a hurling, interestingly enough, it includes a hurling committee on which Brian Lóthain was initially proposed, and Davy Fitzgerald. And of course, they don't see eye to eye these days. There's been some very public spats between them. So Brian Lóthain, I don't think, will be part of that, not while he is. And according to the lads, according to Michael and Dermot, he wasn't keen on serving on the same committee as Davy as long as he was Wexford hurling manager. There's a lot of personality in Clare. You have the Fitzgeralds, you have Brian Lóthain, a strong-willed character, obviously. Anthony Daly, Gerlach Nan, these are all big figures, big personalities, and that has probably underpinned a lot of business in Clare over the last number of years. And really, they have not built on their three All-Ireland under-21 successes in the earlier part of the last decade, or the All-Ireland title in 2013. And they are falling behind as a county. I think that's pretty clear. It made it clear they haven't won an under-20 game since 2015. So there are issues there to tease out. What route, what way they go, obviously will be largely determined on Tuesday night. But it's quite clear that all is not well there.
You were coming in there, Neil?
Yeah, just Colin touched on the personalities, but if leave aside the personalities, the idea that another inter-county manager would be on a committee just seems utterly bizarre and not best practice. And I can't see how anyone would think that could be allowed to proceed. You know, if he's Davy Fitzgerald is Wexford manager, what's he doing on a committee around Clare Hurling?
Yeah, well, that was the county board suggestion. They'd have a committee looking back on things, and it would include every former Clare manager. Although Michael Foley writes, problems quickly emerged. The inclusion of Fitzgerald on the committee reportedly drew a furious reaction from Brian Lóthain, the Clare manager, who objected to the presence while he was still Wexford manager.
Yeah, I just don't see, like, obviously, if you're going down the route of including managers, then yes, he features on that list. But I don't think anyone could see how that would be best practice that you include somebody who's clearly working with another team, you know?
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see how it all plays out. Never dull in Clare. So that board meeting is on next Tuesday to decide what the best way forward is. And it sounds like there's a lot of conflicting views. Something totally different then in The Sun, Neil. Mark McNulty?
Yeah, I just thought it interesting. Owen Cowser has a piece with him, the Cork City goalkeeper. Obviously, he's 40. He's the oldest player in the league. You know, if you reach that age, you're more than likely to have had varied experiences. But the thing about Mark is he hasn't left the club, but even so, he's had very different experiences. He's been at he's basically been there for two boom bust cycles. Like, he was there not playing, but when they won the league in 05, the club was liquidated, refounded in the first division, came up, won the Premier Division in 2017 with Sean Maguire, Kieran Sadley are two players now in the Championship in England. They're relegated again this season. He had kind of looked to take a back seat last year in terms of playing, but ended up playing most of the season. Now he's going again in the first division. And it's just interesting because obviously at Cork City, you know, relegation 3 years after he won the league is a bit of a disaster. but he's actually around long enough to say, you know, this doesn't have to be, there is a way back. Like, it's not an end. There is a pathway back to getting back to where we were before. So, yeah, it's just an interesting read that I suppose the vagaries of League of Ireland clubs.
Yeah. And will they come back, Neil?
It's going to be a competitive division. I know, obviously, the word elite got a lot of attention over the last while, but, you know, there's some big clubs in that division. You've Galway United, who are full-time under the former City manager, John Caulfield. Shelburne have made a number of key appointments, including Alan Caffrey from St. Kevin's as their football and sporting director. So there's actually some reasonable amount of resources being put in at other clubs, so it'll be tough for them.
Okay. Just one final point to finish on. It's on the back page of the Sunday Times. I know, Colm, you mentioned it. I thought it was pretty interesting as well. It's David Walsh talking about Sheikh Mohammed, obviously a huge name in racing, leader of Dubai. And there was a Panorama Investigates programme during the week about the alleged imprisonment of his daughter, Princess Latifah. And this guy's obviously a huge figure in racing, friends with the Queen, all sorts of, you know, embedded really in racing culture in the UK in particular. They reckon he's training up to close to 500 horses, David Walsh reports, at Newmarket alone. That's, you know, a very small town, population of 16,000, and he's a major employer. And the boys in blue, who work at his stables, are best paid and enjoy best conditions, and he's paid for statues, and he's given $1 million to the local school and all sorts. But there's kind of an uneasiness given the emergent situation as documented in Panorama and elsewhere. And David Walsh is, you know, making the point that the racing authorities, I don't know to what extent it's a dilemma, but it's one of those uncomfortable situations for them.
Yeah, I suppose the point being got across here is that there's no move by the British establishment, the government, obviously, no move against the UAE over this from the British government or the UN. And by consequence, the Horse Racing Authority either are not obviously too much up in arms over this. And yet, as David puts it here, within Cambridge, the centre of the Godolphin operation and the primary employer, as he sets out the case here in terms of stud farms and contributions then to the town, and he reflects on a vote in the town council to make Sheikh Mohammed a free man of the town a few years back, but 2018 I think it is, and the unease over that led to them not actually making him a free man. There was a council meeting and there was public submissions, there was public presence at the meeting. So within Cambridge itself, there's clear unease over Sheikh Mohammed and the human rights aspect of his daughter being incarcerated the way she is. And yet the British establishment and the friendship with the Queen remains intact from what we can see. There's no real alarm among the British government or the Horse Racing Authority in England, because obviously he's a huge employer, he's a huge stakeholder, and they don't want to upset that balance over a daughter who is clearly hasn't been seen now for a number of months by friends, but did put out a video which Panorama covered earlier in the week. So really within Cambridge itself, the concern is there, and it's far greater than it is in the British state.
Yeah, and Michael Jeffries emerges as a man of real principle. You won't have heard of Michael Jeffries. He was he taught at the school, the Newmarket Academy, which was on the receiving end of £1 million donation from Sheikh Mohammed. 20,000 books, everything painted, renovated, furniture, computers, electronic flipboards. You mentioned it. The school brought up to, you know, cutting edge territory with £1 million donation. And yet Michael Jeffries was uneasy when the plan was there to make Sheikh Mohammed a free man of the city. Honorary freeman of the city. And so he was one of those who stood up in that meeting and spoke against it. And it says at the end of David Walsh's piece, after the meeting, Jeffries was interviewed on a BBC Look East News bulletin and he spoke about the outcome. People at the Newmarket Academy, that's the school, they suggested it would be better if in the future he avoided saying anything critical of Sheikh Mohammed. He said he could not give that undertaking. In that case, they said, he would have to resign as a school governor. And David Walsh writes, I like the fact that Jeffrey stood up for what he believed, because these days so few do. So kudos to him, because, I mean...
And I suppose the wider point here is, you know, sports washing in the Middle East is very, very common at the moment. And while Sheikh Mohammed has been a long time benefactor of British racing, you know, the World Cup in Qatar, the boxing heavyweight fights that are taking place there, all of that leads into, you know, the clash between price and principle. And it very much manifested in the town of Cambridge with Michael Jeffries. And that's the point that David is making, that at the smallest level, in this man's case, principle outflanked price here. But that's not happening at a much broader level in sport.
No, I think, Neil, generally the sports washing is going just fine.
Yeah. I don't think there are too many questions asked in most sports once the money has been made available. And for Mike Jeffries to stand up like he did in Newmarket and take a stand, what mustn't have been an easy thing to do, given he'd been a teacher there. But like, as Walsh alludes to, not too many people are prepared to make that stand. And, you know, for all the kind of complaints or opposition that's voiced with regards to Qatar, it just doesn't seem to make a difference. Once money is there to be paid, sporting organisations will accept it.
Yeah. Okay, fellas, listen, we're out of time. Thanks so much for that, though. Much appreciated. That was Neil O'Riordan, chief sports writer with The Sun, and Colm Keyes of the Irish Independent, taking us through the Sunday papers. Thanks again, gents.
Thank you.
The Sunday papers on Off the Ball.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.